Welcome to Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness, a weekly podcast where passionate advocates of mental health converge to illuminate unseen struggles faced by millions. Join Jeremy, Terrell, and Lorraine as they delve into candid conversations about stigmas, cultural risk, values, intersectionality, and mental health. Hear from mental health professionals and those diagnosed with a mental illness. Together, they put on the table the things people think about but are afraid to talk about. Get ready to embark on an insightful journey.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Luganville, and I'm one of your hosts. Please meet Terrell Newby and Lorraine Newby, co-hosts.
Hey, Jeremy.
How's it going?
Hey, Terry.
Great, good. Glad to be here. It's our first show. Yes.
Excited.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Long time in coming. We put a lot into your vision and your dream. Can you tell us what Hidden Battles is all about?
Well, you know, hidden battles are the things that we cannot really identify in our lives that are problems. So, you know, there's talk of systemic racism not existing, and that's under the disguise of the guise of law. So we know that the laws aren't discriminatory, so then there's an automatic, yep, must not exist.
Right.
Well, that's just not true. And so Hidden Battles is a way to give people the answers to the problems that they have so that they understand how their environment affects them, how intersectionality affects them, how culture affects them, and how it ends up in the result of creating and causing mental illness, creating and causing substance use problems, physical problems, autoimmune disorders, heart diseases, stroke, all as a result of intersectionality, barriers, racism, generational prejudices, and discrimination. And I think that people are stuck in this narrative that I'm in it myself. All these things that I'm dealing with are my fault and my problem. I might know something's genetic, but really, do I know how my environment, how the laws, or how the powers that be, or the power, the most powerful cultural group in America right now are the white people. And so a lot of the systems that are set up are designed for and by white people, and it may not have been this intentional thing to leave others out. However, there are people that have been left out.
So, intersectionality, let's just talk about those structures that have been in place for years now. So, and I know there are strong foundational pillars that are holding people back from access to financials, healthcare, just to have a life of equality. So let's talk about those structures.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the best place to start is to talk about who are we specifically talking about, and we're talking about people who have certain inabilities. So it could be somebody that's unable to walk, or unable to hear, or unable to see, or unable to, maintain finances healthy enough to fight barriers that may come along financially. There's barriers in gender, and there's barriers in sexuality, and barriers in race. And so when you are not the dominant culture, or you're not of the dominant group, the systems that were set up and designed by the dominant group, and this is worldwide, this isn't just in America, this is everywhere, you don't have the same level of access. You don't have the access pass or the security clearance to get to a certain level that you need to be at. So if you take, for example, you're an individual, let's say that you're a single mother with three children. So gender inherently in and of itself does have some barriers to it. But then you also have three children, so that might put you in a different financial group. So you're in poverty. And then let's say that you're driving on your way to work, you're not paying attention and you hit a stop sign, or you run a stop sign. That ticket is disproportionately going to affect you, because you don't have the financial resources to hire an attorney or to pay that ticket. So then the full authority of the judge is put upon you. I know you're not going to get an attorney for running a stop sign, but I'm just saying, like, that financial impact on you is greater than if you have a multimillionaire who gets a stop ticket. He's handing it over to his executive assistant to put a check in the mail and send it off. So the impact is different. And so... With intersectionality, you know, there are layers within each of those categories. There's legal, or the justice system, which you could argue has turned into an industrial complex. work and access to work and jobs, banking or finances, social ability or social skills, social groups, any type of relational medical access or education, and I mean medical education. And then there's another topic of access to education. If you're somebody that lives in a high stress neighborhood and you have people coming in to educate those children, it may be more difficult to get those kids the education that they need because of, you know, varying, you know, intersectional and environmental impacts. And then you have, you know, physicals, religious, family relations. And we can go back generationally, and they compound and they impact. So
it impacts mental illness.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then that end result, right, the consequences of all those barriers or consequences of all those issues create substance use problems, they create, exactly, mental illness, they create physical problems, which then compound the barrier layers. So let's say generation one, you had a substance use problem and you didn't have healthy relationships with your kids. So then your children decide that they want to go to the war. So then they get trauma and they had an unhealthy. So then they come home and the way that they cope is drink. So then now you're implanting substance use and so on and so forth into your children's lives. And so, and we're talking about any combination of anything that we're talking about generationally compounds over the next. So you might have mentally ill grandparent who raises children. If they inherit that mental illness, the social impacts plus all of these barriers that we're talking about compounds poverty. It compounds your access to education, the barriers to the access to education. So really what we're talking about is an under-resourced population, and in the end, the backdrop of all of that is culture.
Right. The environment and people. My mom was a sociologist and a psychologist, and she used to always talk about how people are products of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to intersectionality, in essence, we're talking about a pool that people are in, and the same generation is jumping in the same pool or coming out of the same pool because of the lack of the things that Jeremy's talking about, the economic. If you don't have the money to manage a certain scenario in your environment, then you know what I'm saying?
Exactly. But who are those? What are those industrial complexes? So people can recognize those and see what those are.
Yeah, and before I get into that, everything that I described is not written. It's only experienced.
Right.
And so how do you quantify in a mind of a person, or how do you get a person to understand that how they've developed is not such a singular issue, that it's an environmental, it's a cultural issue. And so the things that those are the hidden battles we're talking about.
Right.
And so what we're talking about to the audience is trying to get you to understand that all of the world's problems are not the problem. They're the experience of the problem. They're the symptom of the problem. The underlining problem is how we interrelate with intersectionality, how we relate to the barriers of areas of life, which I had said, legal, vocational, financial, social, relational, so on and so forth. And that's what creates the human being. And so how do we fight back? How do we do those things? And so when we're talking, I'm not for or against any particular thing, because in terms of, you know, industrial complexes, right, I think there's pluses and minuses to them, because if we didn't have a food industrial complex, many of our people wouldn't get fed, people around the world wouldn't get fed, but now we understand that there's some consequences to that because we're the most unhealthy society in America right now. That's over true. 50% of American or children have a chronic disease. That's unheard of everywhere else in the world. So something's in America's foods, so we can concentrate on America. Even though we do ship our pork and our food and our beef and whatever out to other people, for some reason, whatever we're eating here, which is probably ultra or highly processed foods, causes those problems. So you have food industrial complexes or military industrial complexes, medical, justice. They've turned to these, like even the college. When college went government funded, prices of college went way up.
Yeah.
And so then they gave out loans to people, then they have to pay that increased cost because there was competition was removed. So you have all the colleges raise their prices way up. So then I, student A, go to get a loan and I'm not educated about the consequences of it. I just see free money because I've lived in poverty. So not only am I getting a loan for the education, but I'm also getting a loan for my books and I'm getting a loan for my living and food. And so they cover all that for you, which it then turns into $100,000 to $150,000 loan at an unrealistic interest rate. And I know that there are certain people that do get actual free dollars for college. Mm-hmm. And I don't, I'm not arguing that people don't actually get some free college, but then the loans to live aren't free. The loans to get the food aren't free. The loans that you get in your master's degree aren't free. So then the person goes in thinking, wow, I'm going to get a job that proportionately pays me more. That if I just went and got a job, it's going to pay me enough over to cover the loan, which is not true. And then you're stuck. I'm highly educated. I fell into that specific trap myself, and now I've got $140,000 in student loans that I've not paid off.
Well,
but we're talking about the industrial complexes,
right?
And so these things are, and so industrial complexes control each of these areas. They're corporately controlled. Our justice system is controlled by corporations. Our work obviously is controlled by corporations. Our banking and finances are controlled, and the industrial complex is the power is no longer competitive. It is essentially a monopoly. It's a corporate monopoly that owns a wide area of how we live.
That we have to live and operate.
Right.
Within.
Right.
And just going back to the student loans, I understand that because, you know, my student loans are just absorbent. And I know there's going to come a time that they're going to have to be paid back. But I've heard stories where doctors had a student loan and their offices and equipment and everything, they had to shut down because they were unable to pay their student loan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it can be devastating.
So, the hidden battles as it pertains to mental illness permeates throughout everything in society. And so, I guess what I hear you saying is that intersectionality is the root of what permeates in terms of certain levels or certain types of mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I want to throw out at you is that, I don't know if our audience knows this, is that nearly 30% of Americans suffer from mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, there's more attention paid to only 12% of Americans who suffer from diabetes. Why is that? What's going on with that?
So, you know, that's a pretty wide, and we could do a whole show, you know, specific to that. But my guess is the reason why, you know, it's a testimonial effect in psychology or testimonial effect in psychological research is that you have to be careful of a narrative that's being told to you through multiple sources. So let's say an industrial complex is the media industrial complex. They can put out, you know, the BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, Fidelity can put out a news article of a way that they want something controlled down to let's say CNN or whoever, and CNN spreads that out across the country, and so you've got 100 or 200 news programs reading off the exact same article that came from one person, and that could, I'm just making this up, but let's say it's a diabetic medication because they're trying to up their stock in the diabetic medication, and diabetic medication might be more expensive than mental health medication. So as a business owner myself, I would ask, well, I'm gonna get the best bang for my buck. I may not make as much off of mental health medications than diabetes, you know, or there could be some regulatory issue, or there could be, you know, something advancing that. But yeah, I mean, why isn't America paying attention to, you know, mental health issues? There's stigma. There's you know, discrimination associated with it. We still live in a culture where mental health issues are, even though they've been the bedrock, mental health has been the bedrock, or mental illness has been the bedrock of every human's behavior since the beginning of time. Yet we don't talk about it. There's no talk rules. You know, there. You know, I've heard you guys tell stories about your experiences and, you know, my own experiences, like in the white community, especially in Nebraska, if somebody's an alcoholic in your family, shut up. If you got touched in your swimsuit area, shut up. You know, don't talk about it, move on. And we're finally breaking those barriers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think when it comes down to the diabetes and mental health, I think that, you know, to me, if I had the capacity to make medications for diabetes and mental health, I'd want both. And that's exactly why I think we're seeing more of mental health medication being advertised. And I don't want to say that we don't want people to have access to their diabetes medications, or to say, would you like to have a farm-to-table program in your school? 300 million, minus the Heinz family, would raise their hand. You know, and I'm not trying to go after the Heinz family. I'm just trying to say, like, how do we as a society bring whole healthy foods to every single child in America? Then, how do we bring whole health care? If I'm a doctor, I'm going to take those payouts. I'm going to take that, you know, I'm going to push that med for you so that I can get my little kickback. I'm going to do those extra things. But if I can get paid to be a doctor, and I can live off of that, and it's worth my time and my investment, and if the food part's taken care of, then me as a doctor, I'm not dealing with 1,000 different illnesses or an average of like 2 or 3 chronic, I think there's an average of 2 chronic illnesses per person, or I'll have to look it up. I'll mm-hmm. fact check myself later.
But Jeremy, all that sounds great. At the end of the day, man, you have cultures who, when it comes to mental illness, say, well, you know what, we're not going to share that. It's a personal situation. We're going to pray. We're going to go to church. We're going to talk to pastor. Because we are talking about destigmatizing.
Yeah.
So there's this mindset that some cultures have is that, look, it's our business. We don't want to tell anybody about Johnny, Uncle so-and-so, who's in the bedroom and you're sliding food under there and you're pushing the tray back. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so, and some of this stuff is like generational.
Sure.
So a lot of people are not educated to the fact that if you take Uncle So-and-so to see someone who's trained professionally to help not only him, but help the entire family, and then the next generation won't continue to do the same thing.
And so what you're talking about is micro-intervention. What can you do on the ground, at home? What can you do in the schools, in the neighborhood? And so there's a micro-intervention, and I think for the most part, we do the best that we can with micro-interventions. And I think that as, you know, we publicize and we destigmatize, but remember what stigma was structurally built. We see it in the intersectionality. Right. Destigmatizing it is teaching people how to destructure those systems in order to reduce barriers and increase resources. So the government's job is to protect its people. Are they protecting us from NIH, FDA, EPA, LMNOP? No, the corporations donate to them or give them money for funding, and then of course they're not gonna beat up their rich uncle.
Exactly.
So we have to get control of our government again, getting our food, our medicines, our you know, education system. We have to get those things back into control of the family, so that is a macro intervention. And so when we have healthier foods, mental illness is decreased. When we have healthier, you know, or effective medical care, mental health decreases. When we have, you know, fair banking and fair housing and those kinds of rules, mental illness decreases. And so that is destructuring.
You're talking utopia. How do we, and that's great, and we want that. I'm jumping in because for those that are listening and watching this, it's like, okay, well, right now, when I see some guy who looks like he's out of his mind, I think he's a menace to my society. Why can't you, you know, sweep up all these people mm-hmm. who are talking to themselves, you know, who don't seem to understand what the hell I'm talking about? Why are these people on the street?
Well, you know, obviously there's still the effects of, you know, and multiple layers of intersectionality of folks that are being created. So what you're talking about is mental ability. People that have a lower sense of mental ability, they're, you're not welcome in my neighborhood, get out of my neighborhood.
Exactly.
You're not welcome in my hospital, you're not welcome, and which is stigma and prejudice. And when those people mm-hmm. experience that, there are actual laws that are supposed to be protecting them from those things. And so when you go into a hospital and you're being discriminated against based on ability, you should have the access or the ability to sue them or whatever the case may be, but you don't have the finances or the education
exactly.
to do so.
Exactly.
So that you say, well, what you're talking about, Jeremy, is a utopia. Do I think that America can be structurally perfect? I think it can, as long as the people hold those agencies accountable. Some way or somehow, there's been this corporate capture of all of the narratives, and so we're believing, we have people that are watching mainstream news who literally believe that either Kamala Harris is the devil and everybody's gonna die, or Trump is gonna get in and everybody's gonna die, but they forget that three-fourths of the fault of where we're at is because of Congress.
Right, and still, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And still we have everyday Americans, regardless of their political affiliations, regardless of
which is
their
all
ethnicity,
design.
Right? We're talking about human beings who are
right.
suffering every day, and that's what we're talking about with Hidden Battles, destigmatizing mental illness. I mean, we did a documentary and we covered what? What did we cover? What was some of the symptoms of the clients that we did stories on?
Schizophrenia. Bipolar,
yeah, diagnosis, yeah, bipolar,
yeah,
borderline personality disorder,
schizoaffective, yeah.
psychotic disorders.
And
so
what did we find out? What did we learn? What did we learn by speaking with the parents of their children who, one, they didn't understand, and then two, when they found out information, knowledge, and the struggles that they went through?
And that's, again, another micro-intervention. So we did, hopefully it turns into a macro-intervention, but you know, somebody actually took the time to create, you know, and I'm not saying there hasn't been other films out there, but we took a lot of time to create a film that shows the true face of people with mental health issues. That once they're treated, once Uncle Joe, you know, is no longer getting his food slid under the door and he gets some medication, he can participate in society. And he can be an active, and he can be a taxpayer. And I said that in the film, is that when you get people better, which you can with severe mental illness or with mental illness in general, when you get people better, they produce, which is what we want every human to do. We want to, which is purpose. We have a purpose. Our purpose is to produce something, whether it's happiness, wealth, education, you know, whatever your purpose, you know, is. Now we move into somebody who can move out of the areas of intersectionality. And so if I'm an unabled person, now I become able-bodied, I can become employed, I can pay for things, I can pay for my ticket, I can pay for a lawyer, I can pay for things, you know, maybe depending on the person, varying degrees. And so when we're talking about destigmatizing the actions between family members, that's education, and that's providing real resources to people that quite truthfully aren't there yet. And that's one of our initiatives, is to create the family coalition, you know,
right.
and that nonprofit, so that families can start taking control of the narrative again. So, hey, you know what? I try to take my child to you and you turn me away. Or I need
exactly.
a residence for my client or my family member, you know, because I'm not unable to take care of them because I have other children or I have other obligations or whatever, which is fine. You know,
right.
there's nothing wrong with asking and getting and receiving the professional help for your children, but it's just not there. You know, you have
exactly.
a missing. Yeah.
Right.
Like, how many parents have dropped their children off because they couldn't take care of them, put them into the foster care, so then the state was forced to take care of them then.
Exactly.
Right. So, and I know we talked to a lot of parents where, you know, years ago, we look at 20 years ago, you think we don't have resources now. They were zipped then, so they didn't have any. And they didn't have the technology that we do now, so they didn't understand the illnesses as we do now. So they were just at point zero. And so they did a lot of suffering going through just with the illness of their children. So now our goal is to, one of the goals is to start the Hidden Battles Mental Health Family Advocacy Group. And this will entail a group of parents coming together where they can have a voice, the resources, the help, families, supporting families, something that a lot of them that we've talked to that didn't have is just that support among other people, because it can be, and it was, a shameful thing, or where you are ashamed of your child having an illness that you didn't understand and no one else around you could really explain it to you. So therefore it became under the table or hidden. And so that is what Hidden Battle is about, is talking about those hidden battles, bringing them to light with the resources, the support, and, you know, hopefully to get a petition together to where we can get those signatures and send that to legislature to maybe change, implement a bill that helps the serving of the mentally ill.
And being able to break those down into different topics, because, you know, these families are going to have a lot of issues that need to be dealt with, and how do we break those down? And so my goal is 1 million signatures. If we can get 1 million signatures and we show that to any politician, I promise you, your bill will be passed. And these bills will be developed and designed by family members, and we'll have a professional lobby group help lobby those bills. And when that lobbyist is carrying 1 million family member signatures, I promise you. So, you know, if at all, or if anything that family members do out there is at least put your name down saying, I support this particular deal. And it could be just be typing your name in. We'll figure that out when we get there. But, you know, there was just $15 million taken from Nebraska for mental health issues, you know, kind of unilaterally. And there was a big uproar. And I promise you, if we had 1 million family member signatures, never would have happened.
Exactly.
So, my mind is going back to, we met a principal, a retired principal, who has a teenager that wants to kill himself every day.
Mm.
And he has adjusted his whole schedule to be home with that kid to keep him from having maladaptive behaviors. And this educated man was not cognizant of certain modalities that can help him, as opposed to him having to tote that load by himself.
Mm.
This is what we're talking about, educating people, getting the word out that you don't have to do this on your own, and there's no shame.
Experienced barriers. You know, and he is educated. I'm assuming he must have a decent income.
Yeah.
So he does have some of the resources that other people may not to fight back. But again, let's not forget that if we're all in this together, there are layers of barriers, and there's classes within classes of people. And so just because he is a wealthier person you know, is educated, doesn't mean that he does not experience stigma and discrimination.
Exactly.
You know, his son,
right,
having a mental health issue, they might be experiencing it. They might be experiencing the relationships. You know, is that son getting the proper psychological and mental health care? If not, that's a stigmatizing and discriminatory practice.
Right.
Mm. And a part of that, I think, is the secrecy.
Yeah.
And just because of the secrecy, he may not be getting those services that he needs, those resources.
Sure.
Yeah. And seriously, this guy's like, well, maybe it's time for him to, like, go out on his own and live on his own. And it's like, no, I want to say absolutely not.
Sure.
he needs
but where
to be...
are the resources? So I'm assuming this person's an adult. The son is an adult.
Yeah. He's what, 8? What is he?
28
years old.
Yeah. So where does the government need to step in and help this individual? And you know, I guess I don't know, I didn't really expect to go here, but if you are a utilitarian, you have to understand that if only you help other people, it's so that it doesn't hurt you.
Absolutely.
And so if you give that vaccine, or you give that mental health care, or you give that, you don't have people shooting in your neighborhood.
Exactly.
You don't have parents, you know, abandoning kids. And so if you make that investment, you destigmatize mental illness, you destigmatize and you take an inner look at yourself, and you make those investments wherever you can, that is going to come back to you by way of avoidance.
Right.
So if you are healing those sick and the poor, and you're getting them better, they're not in your neighborhood bothering you and looking weird.
Exactly.
You know, so so if you don't care about helping other people in terms of, you know, whatever altruism is, or you know, based on spirituality or based on some sort of moral principle, at least from a utilitarian perspective, help these folks out so they don't come bother you later.
And we just want to go back to a topic, because you mentioned one of those layers is religion. And that's another aspect in the African American community, because we're highly spiritual individuals and love to pray and believe in our religion, and we believe that our religion can cure everything in our lives, financial, health, mental illness, everything. We, and some believe that, you know, we don't have to go to the doctor. We can just pray about it. So we need to just talk about that for those individuals at home or that are listening that feel like, I don't need any of these resources. I can just pray about it. And I know that my faith, you know, is going to make everything right.
Well, let's not forget that I can show you 50 to 100 studies that show that if you have a strong moral foundation and if you have a strong spiritual connection, the chances of you recovering are higher than people that don't. So we have to reinforce, please do not stop believing in something higher than yourself. As a matter of fact, America, since America has been de-religionized, I made that up, but basically as people are destructuring religion and spirituality, and you know, it's, there's less increase, there's a decrease in participation of religious activities in the Christian faith, and by way of resentment, God wouldn't do this to me, or if there was a God there with this thing, and so on and so forth. And so what you're doing is you're stripping families and children of moral beliefs, a foundation, the God command theory. You're destructuring why I don't behave or why I do behave a specific way. So then you remove that, then I'm left up to my own satiated wants and needs. And I do whatever I want, because if there is no God, then why behave? And so as we're destructuring religion and removing it from the United States, we're also not increasing philosophical conversations about other ways to behave and other ways and reasons why we behave the way that we do. And I'm just trying to, I wanted to get that in there, because as we're removing religion from schools, you're not allowed to pray, you're not allowed to do these things, you know, our country is being disproportionately affected. And so if you have children who are in poverty, or let's say, whatever, who need a spiritual connection, it's being removed systematically and systemically from our country. But then I think to what your larger point was, is like, sure, religion is an important part, and it should be the foundation of every decision that you make, or spirituality should be. So what, but I can promise you, if we're talking about Christianity, Jesus was a community. He went around helping others. So what you're denying is people's Christianity by not allowing them to help you, or denying their purpose. So if you don't display your children to help, to saying, here, I'm laying my child at your feet because I'm embarrassed, who's really the problem? It's not your child now, it becomes your fault. So you gotta be able to say, I need to lay my children at your feet and trust you because I've investigated you, I've looked, I've talked to you, I know you're, you know, I did my education to make sure that you're the right one. Now I'm trusting you, and I'm trusting God to bring my child into other God's children's hands.
And that's a good way to put it, because as spirituality as a base is a must, and I know we've lost that in America, as you say, it's been stripped away from our schools, and prayer's been stripped away, and we've seen some of the consequences of that, you know, with pregnancy and drugs, suicide,
mm-hmm.
From teens and youth. The basis that I like to place here is that spirituality is, the religion is the foundation. It is the foundation. And we have to understand, like you said, bringing our kids, bringing our uncles or our loved ones to those facilities or resources out there that are there to help us, and trusting in that also. Like you said, if God may lead you to take your kid to that facility for help. So as in the African-American community, it's okay to look for other resources for help, you know, or a certain doctor. You know, doctors they can help people also.
I find it interesting that, not to sound cynical, I think it's a fact though, when everyone finds religion or some spiritual connection, when there's a tragedy in your family, let's just take mental illness, and a lot of times I've heard you talk about, you never know, with a snap of a finger, you or someone very close to you could come down with a certain mental illness via an accident or just something that happens in their lives. And now I've got some religion because now it hits home to me. When you talk about how people make the assumptions, they look over here and go, oh my God, that poor person. But it's really closer than what we think it is in terms of having to deal with mental illness and the stigma associated with it. Now it's in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So now what?
Right. And that's the thing that like what I said, if not only for the goodness of it, do it for the utilitarian reason. Stop being, one of our clients ended up in somebody's backyard and they were smelling and picking the flowers. The lady handled it great. She just talked to him, was very nice to him, and called the police department. The police department got a hold of him and took him back to his house. And so not everybody's a danger. One of the thoughts that I had when you were describing that is cancer's also potentially around the corner. All of these other issues are always potentially around the corner.
Right.
And people need to understand that one of the causes of cancer is intersectionality and discrimination and being under-resourced. When you're stressed out, you have higher incidences of cancer. When when women in the United States now have a 1 in 8 chance of getting breast cancer, never heard of it, you know, before. You had back in the 60s, it was 1 in 10,000, Americans had autism. In California, it's 1 in 8. So these things are compounding, and like I said, they're generationally increasing. And I'm not asking for utopia. Can we go back to the, and I'm not talking about the social status, but I'm talking about the health status,
exactly,
of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
To whatever extent there was good there. So I'm not looking for the perfection of it. I'm looking for fighters. I'm looking for people that are willing to stand up every day and put their name down. I'm looking for somebody to make that next right move to what do you say, pass it along, or what's that called when you do?
Forward.
Pass it, pop, yeah. Pay it forward.
Pay it forward.
And do those things. And sometimes it pay it forward to the people that you don't
exactly
think you would want to, because they're unattractive, they're ugly, they're obese, they're not of the race that you desire or whatever, or the sexual orientation that you desire. You know, because in the end, the way that we treat the most disenfranchised or the least, powerful people is a direct reflection of our character and our
exactly
moral. Our morality is not designed to be tested by all of the people that we love. It's designed to be tested by the people that we hate.
That's good. On that note, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness, a weekly podcast where passionate advocates of mental health converge to illuminate unseen struggles faced by millions. Join Jeremy, Terrell, and Lorraine as they delve into candid conversations about stigmas, cultural risk, values, intersectionality, and mental health. hear from mental health professionals, and those diagnosed with a mental illness. Together, they put on the table the things people think about, but are afraid to talk about. Get ready to embark on an insightful journey.
Somewhere in your neighborhood, families are suffering from severe mental illness.
They put me in here because I tried to kill myself, which is extremely fucked up because I tried to kill myself.
And I ended up running my car into the Capitol.
Loved ones looking for answers.
I didn't know what to do. I really did not know what to do because I felt very alone at times. I felt like there really was no one that understood what I was going through.
And I remember the doctor telling me on the phone that lower your expectations. Lower your expectations, and that it wasn't going to be like you thought it was going
to be. I'm sorry, baby girl. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me.
Is the perception of mental illness fact or plain old stigma?
They didn't want their kids to be friends with me because they were afraid their kids would catch what I had.
Can someone that self-harms function on their own?
You need to take a look at the darkness and bring it into the light and understand that your behavior, your discrimination, your hate, your side comments, your jokes actually kill people.
Hidden Battles, destigmatizing mental illness.
Jerome shares his thoughts that Black celebrities should stand up and fight for what is right.
So, just like Michael Jordan, when we were complaining that he wasn't supporting one party or the other, he says, well, as far as I'm concerned, the last time I checked, there were no Democrats or Republicans, Blacks and Whites, buy my shoes. Mm. Okay. He put money into this.
Yeah, from a financial perspective. but still made me angry because, like, she's somebody that can be a uniter. That's somebody that she did on her show. She brought so many different perspectives and so many different therapies and so many different stuff. And then she hops on board with the Democrats, which is just a small fraction of the population.
Think about it. How could she go silent and she supported Barack? I mean, it's the pressure.
Her and Trump are buddies. Until he ran for it, until he became racist. That's what I'm saying.
Everybody's buddies with Trump.
What I can tell you is this much.
In the past, they were. Okay.
What makes me mad is that she had the opportunity as an independent candidate to say, you know what, I don't even like Kennedy. But you know what? America needs to get its shit together. Tyler Perry's one of them. You know, you have these powerhouses in the Black community, and I don't know who has control of them.
What are you talking about? First of all, if you get
on that Democratic stage without threat. I put that on my mind.
Listen.
Nah.
Okay, well, I'm not saying no.
She felt obligated.
She felt threatened.
Absolutely. Jeremy, that's my point.
Bye.
Okay, there are so many things that happen.
BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. Hey, look, if you want us to support Oprah.com, if you want us to support the channel, you better get your ass up on that motherfucking stage and you better spout it out.
Of course, but that's with everything, Jeremy.
But why don't you come out and be brave? And do you think that she's going to lose her money?
Jeremy.
Hell no.
Jeremy. There, it's the politics. The politics is just rampant throughout our society.
But you don't make a point.
And a lot of people go silent. A lot of people don't say shit. Like, I look at all the poverty that's out there. Let's just say black people getting together, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
All these millionaires out there.
Uh-huh.
Why can't they get together and do something about that?
Well, let me
why
ask you this question.
Their money together?
Yeah. How come Oprah has a there's 20, there's can you look up how many banks exist in America, please?
I mean, what, African American money?
No, but
banks.
Only one.
Have we talked about this already?
We talked about that.
How many banks
black
are
banks
in America?
How many banks?
Look, 4,577.
Okay.
There's only 25 black owned banks.
Right.
Right.
Out of that.
Why isn't she starting her own bank, Tyler Perry? Like they
Exactly.
But you get what I'm saying? Okay,
so let me share a quick story with you. In Nashville, Tennessee,
if I don't understand the culture, if I don't understand what's going on, tell me.
Again.
But come on.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, when she started her school, she went to Africa and helped the people there. And we're like, well, what about the people in your backyard? You know what I mean? Yeah, why not start a school here for the lower income people? Or
because if she went in, you're going against the teachers union.
Why do you have to go to Africa?
Because if you try to start a private school for black girls in America, that's a charter school or a private school, you're going to piss off the teachers union. And they're one of the most powerful unions in the world.
Really?
Absolutely. So
and
she
that's
is
a shame.
And
so,
absolutely, it's a shame.
And so, and then it's
and good for her. Like, so my let me be clear. I love Oprah. I love what she's done. I love how her success. I love the contributions that she's made to our country. But at some point, these leaders have to move beyond their corporate captors. They have to.
Well,
they all need to have a fucking secret society, skull and bones meeting together, Illuminati, and they just sit down and they just say, look. We're done.
Jeremy, it's about this.
Yeah,
it is about that. But
no,
how much of that do you need?
She's
a gajillionaire, and the whole Tyler Perry leave.
You're going to see things happen to them. You're going to see their businesses start to crumble.
But if America starts to understand that that's what the punishment, let's argue that Trump received from going against the grain of what the corporatocracy says has to happen, and they see that's what happened to Trump, all these lawsuits and all this shit that they have to deal with, but if America starts to see that that's happening everywhere, then Oprah needs to come out and say, look, America, I've been in your living rooms for decades. I need your help. These people, I'm standing up for you. I'm finally standing up for you. I'm breaking away from the corporatocracy. I'm telling you the truth, and I need your vote, or I need your support, or I need your protest, or I need this, or I need that.
So,
and you're telling me that she had $40 million in real estate, that somebody's going to take it? No, they ain't.
Okay. So, there are a lot of people that depend on Oprah.
Yeah.
She employs a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute she starts talking that way, she's got tax problems. It's just
lawsuits. You name it.
Okay.
I agree.
And so,
but what else? What purpose do you have?
Jeremy, what you're saying.
What other purpose should you have to lay on?
So what I see these people doing is doing the best they can within the boundaries of the people that are funneling money into them to keep them propped up. And then there's a certain lifestyle that they're accustomed to. And so they try to work within the peripherals of all of what you're talking about without losing it.
Do this 100 times at IDHS. You start with our food. People are mad because we weren't overfeeding people. Well, why wouldn't we do that from an intersectionality perspective? Because we don't want to endorse their obesity.
Right.
We don't want to endorse the insulin. We don't want to give ice cream and cakes.
Yeah.
But we have employees who feel as though the amount of food or the visual effect that they see when they get their plate is they're not getting enough, when in reality, that's the amount of food that the average American should be taking. You don't need three layers of a McChicken and a triple large fry, 4,000 chicken nuggets, and a Diet Coke.
Yeah,
like Diet Coke.
Like the Golden Corral.
Yeah. Exactly. So when you see the meal site, oh my God, you're starving these poor people. No, you just have the wrong perception.
And so, plus, you're teaching them to eat healthier.
Right, and we're giving them foods that they can afford when they get out.
Exactly.
And it's from the same grocery store we all shop from. It's interesting, but.
But that's twofold, because IBHS is in the business of changing lives,
right,
and then changing the medical, the health system.
Right, right.
To better serve.
Right. On the ground, grassroots, on the bottom.
Could a farm-to-table program be an option for Nebraska's taxpayers?
Public schools have all this stuff on the menu that does not help children not have diabetes.
Or trans fats.
Or whatever.
Exactly.
Right. And why don't the school systems sit down and get serious about helping these kids with their diets? Do they really give a shit?
I think they presume the value, I think they're presuming the family values, and really they're superimposing their values, and they're running it like a business rather than really understanding what the family value is. So let me ask you this question. Would you vote for property tax increase to bring a farm-to-table program to Nebraska?
I would.
Who wouldn't?
Right.
But they'll tell you, well, the reason why we want Lunchables and why we want Da Vinci's and why we want Godfather's Pizza is because they can just deliver the shit in a box. There's a shortage of people. There's a shortage of this. They think there's a shortage of helpers or workers because nobody wants to work in the food and health industry for children. No, they don't want to work in it because it's a disgusting thing. Nobody wants to sit around and make poisonous food for children.
Exactly.
Why would we want to do that? You know, and so to me, it gets a little bit frustrating because the government or these forces superimpose their values. They think that the cheaper, it's the industrial, way of doing things. It's the assembly line, the least amount of resources to produce the most amount of product, and you get the most outcome from it. So they don't care about, the value. They're running it like a business, and they don't need to be running it like a business. They need to be running it like a home.
So what's the point of the PTA? Why can't the PTA grab the bull by the horns and stop this shit from happening? Or are they in on the fix? What's going on with that?
No, I don't think that. I think the parent, like when I was looking at the Clinton Neighborhood Association's Facebook, they're actively involved. They're actively involved in neighborhood cleanups. These people really care about their communities. I just wonder if some of the topics are out of their control. So like the Common Core curriculum. I'm just guessing here, but when the federal standard is to do this in at Clinton Neighborhood Organization, and the public schools in Lincoln actually are highly involved with children with learning disabilities and developmental disabilities, and they've got many resources, mental health care and all these types of things, but that's not the role of an educator. But somehow or another, they become the doctor, the lawyer, the CPS worker, the whole thing. And can my kid just go to school, get some healthy food, and learn and go home? So at Clinton, it's a very diverse group of people, and you have various cultures within that school system. So you have potentially children coming in who eat a particular type of food at home, and then they go to school, and they're eating American food or American-style food, and they're getting sick, and so... To me, there's just some basic categories of things that we need to do. We need to understand what Lincoln's children need to learn in each school district. So if I'm out in Alliance, kids out there with their culture, the way that they exist, is different than Clinton.
Right.
And so the public school systems need to have the flexibility. But when you talk about flexibility, you talk about complication. You talk about problems. That's like treating mental illness. You can't treat it with one glove. You have to have multiple ways of approaching, and it's equity. It's like getting people what they need, not what everybody wants. So, if one kid, I know I'm stretching here, but if you have a kid from an Arab country, we should be encouraging, influencing, and rather than giving the money to the school for the food, we should be giving the Arab parent the food money so that they can prepare their ethnic foods for the children to take to school.
And that's sounds good, but for most people, it's like, I'm not going for that. I'm not going to pay some Arab family and my taxpayers' money is not for that family, okay? Mm-hmm. And the other side of it is, I don't want someone telling me that my kid pouring ketchup on his hamburger is bad. I don't want someone telling me what kind of foods my kid needs to eat. That's my business. So don't tell me that by my kid drinking sodas is a bad thing for their health. Okay, I want them to grow up the way that I did. Look at me, I'm fine. So get out of my business, leave me alone.
Does he have control to put stuff up on the TV?
We do. Yeah.
Can you do it right now?
Yeah.
Hey, can you bring up, just say, what was the original purpose of ketchup?
Yeah, medicine.
For diarrhea.
But you catch my drift. Like, it depends on the narrative of the day. Back then, it was a medicine that you go pick up and
right.
you drink it.
Right.
Because it's full of tomatoes, because it helps indigestion and diarrhea.
Right.
Okay. But now, we use it as a paste, you know, to make a flavor enhancer.
As a condiment.
So, if you're mad at me, you know, what I'm trying to say is like, if I'm going to give you education that the sodium level or whatever type of chemicals are introduced into ketchup, if you're telling me the facts and I'm a parent and I'm being educated, so we sit at Clinton Neighborhood and we do a presentation with the families and you know, we have an assembly and we're telling them about ketchup and we say, look, this is what ketchup is.
Yeah.
Do what you want, but we just want you to choose from an informed perspective.
Right.
With all things, you want information, and really what it comes down to is money. And some of the things that Lincoln has done really well in is like bringing in food stamps and allowing food stamps to be allowed to be used at the farmer's market,
mm-hmm.
you know, in different places so people have access. Community gardens have kind of developed,
mm-hmm.
you know, so more of those kind of grassroots efforts and teaching people how to, you know, garden or keep a couple chickens in their backyard. You can let them run around, they eat, and you have more eggs than you can handle just with four chickens.
Mm-hmm.
So four chickens will feed a family breakfast. For century, oh, for till you die.
Right, right.
I've had 50 something, so and I couldn't give enough away. So, you know, there's certain small tasks that you can do. You can buy four chickens for $1.50 a piece, feed them till they get grown up, and then they eat the grass, and you know, they eat in the grass in the backyard, and then pretty soon they're giving you your breakfast. Whole health, farm fresh, no pesticides, no nothing, just eggs.
And Jeremy, I think the change is not going to happen until the parents get involved. As you mentioned, the PTA. But it has to be more than just a school program, PTA. It has to actually be the parents creating and having a voice about their kids and wanting something better to eat.
And I totally agree. That's where I think that like when we were, when I typed up that letter for the family, that first meeting,
mm-hmm.
it's like you have to restore the family. The family's right. been left out of
right.
every conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Every conversation. I don't care who the family is, what the ethnicity is, what the gender is, what the sexual orientation is. Nobody invites family members. And then you're making, like Saudi Arabia is pumping the hell out of water in our country in order to produce hay that they chop down and send back to Saudi Arabia. And well owners, farmers, their wells are going dry.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the state and the people that, you know, bargained with Saudi Arabia to use our water to grow their hay to feed their cattle, do you think that the family was brought in to have that conversation? Heck no, it wasn't. And these are happening in small communities across America, and I wish that there was a way that we could kind of unify those families and come up with an agenda where we can all say, okay, well, you're in a fight in Illinois. Well, us in Nebraska, we want to be able to fight with you and for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Here's how we can do that.
Exactly.
Let's
right.
join the forces.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is that her?
That concludes Hidden Battles Destigmatizing Mental Illness podcast. Join in every week. Be sure to subscribe, like, and share. Join in next week, when the advocates talk about intersectionality and what every family needs, their own family mission, vision, and values. Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness, podcast.